Blog Talk Radio.
Now, in its second edition, Carol Dean's popular book, The Art of Film Funding, has 12 new chapters to cover all areas of film financing and how to avoid expensive pitfalls. Learn how to start with an idea and end with a trailer. How to make an ask for money. Create your story structure and your trailer. Legal advice. Fair use. Successful crowdfunding, how to ask for music rights, and what insurance you can't shoot without. Available on Amazon under Carol Dean and at FromTheHeartProductions.com. Hi and welcome to The Art of Film Funding. I'm your co-host, Claire Papin, along with Carol Dean, author of the best-selling book, The Art of Film Funding. Carol is also the founder and president of From the Heart Productions and the host of this show. Lee Rudnicki is our guest. He's an entertainment lawyer with 15 years of experience. He's also a producer and adjunct law professor. In addition to his legal studies, Lee has a music degree and is a graduate of the UCLA Professional Screenwriting Program. He's also produced or is an associate producer of 13 motion pictures, served as music producer on 2, and wrote a vampire novel, My Immortal. And Carol and I want to thank you, Lee, for joining us today.
Good morning.
Good morning, Lee. You know, you're the first attorney I know who is a musician, who is actively working in the film business with titles of music producer, writer, and producer. So let's start with, how can you achieve so much in one lifetime?
Wow. Well, I don't know if I have achieved all that much, but I do think I do a number of different things. The thing to know about me is that I have a creative background and then became an entertainment lawyer. I wasn't an entertainment lawyer who decided to be creative later on in the game. So for me to be able to do, work in different capacities, it was a natural evolution to go through, musician to lawyer to music lawyer and then and technology into film. I have to be very, very good at time management and organization. I'm generally the one drafting the business plan for the movie or the artist or whatever. So that's my long, rambling answer for that.
That is great, but this is really important. I'll tell you something. I have a dear friend in New York who was a musician. He played bass. And he went to law school and became a lawyer, very successful lawyer, and he just plays for enjoyment now. He took the law route rather than the music route. So there's got to be something going on here in some part of the brain that there's some help with learning all of that, of what you learned from music and applying it to learning the lawyer. The law school. So your resume said that when you enrolled in law school, you applied the Drum Corps work ethic to learning the law. Could you explain what this ethic is?
Sure. So I grew up in Pennsylvania, and at around seventh grade, I started drumming, and I got really interested in drumming. And at a very early time, I had seen this thing called Drum Corps, which is kind of the very high-level competitive percussion. And I kind of fell in love with that, but I really figured out very quickly I had little to no natural ability to start. So for me, what I learned to do was really to focus, 24/7 on a goal and through doing that. And I eventually, got to see some drum corps and got to know more. And then when I was in the seventh grade, I was in Montreal and I had seen the world champions and I had said, I'm going to teach them someday. I don't care what it takes. And I told all my friends this and I got ridiculed, of course, and laughed. 12 years later, I did it. And that was, I think the one gift I got out of drum corps more than all was when you truly tell yourself you can do something, you can do it. But then fast forward, boom, you're a drummer in law school, and they're talking about a plaintiff, and I literally had no idea what they were talking about on day one. And it was, you know, a month into school, I had a professor tell me it wasn't going to work out. I should drop out. So for me, that's where it was, you know, you really take that process of, okay, as a filmmaker, producer, lawyer, whatever, I'm going to focus 110, 150% on law school. And I was able to do that. I had straight A's my second year, which was funny because the professor who had that talk with me became a good friend, and we laugh about it. So.
Incredible. And you believe all of this is because you made that your goal and your major focus. You just focused on law school above everything else in your life?
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, for me, it was all about the work ethic. And you know, hey, I might fail out. It's okay to fail at things, but you're not going to outwork me. So if you look on my website, for example, Drum Law 80, well, I was a drummer. I became a lawyer. And the 80 is actually a tribute to a football player, Jerry Rice. It's not a, wow, here's my hero in life or anything. It's, here is the example of the work ethic that I'm going to show, that I'm going to demonstrate, is this top. And I think when you see really successful filmmakers, really successful actors or whatever, they all tend to kind of, in different ways, come to that same conclusion about focus. And you really make the decision, hey, because financing a film, if you think about how difficult it really is, it's ridiculous to even try. I mean, for right, on paper, but there's always a way to persevere if you really want to do it. And I think that's a skill set successful producers have.
Well, I think if in the beginning, when you started making a film, if you knew everything you had to do, you would never start, probably. We would have probably a third of the films made that we have, particularly in the documentary field. So I do find that it's shocking to some people when you open their eyes, because now I'm teaching documentary filmmakers that they should be marketing their film within the first 6 months of producing it. So, and they don't want to hear that self-distribution now is a good word. It's a good thing. You make more money that way.
Mm.
But there is a lot to learn. So you were successful in getting through college with good grades just by determination. Focus, tenacity were the key words for you, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's a caveat is that if you look on my blog, there's these I have these seven principles of my kind of my entertainment industry plan. And one of them, or along with that focus, comes a belief in having fun and enjoying your work, because, you know, life could end at any time for anyone. And it's really about, if you're making a movie or you're doing X, Y, and Z, it's not about walking up the red carpet at Cannes. That may be the ultimate goal. That may be the great thing at the end of the day. But if you went through 8 months of the worst time of your life and you hate everybody when it's done, what's the point? So I think that's the caveat to my approach.
It's the journey, not the destination.
Yeah, I love working on movies. And the teams that I work on, we share that passion and have fun and love getting on the phone to talk about the script or anything like that. And the conflict, you know, combat method of production, I don't subscribe or participate in that. I can help it.
Great. I totally agree with you. So I know you write contracts. So tell us what type of contracts you write for filmmakers. Do you do all of their attachments? Do you do contracts for everyone they attach?
Okay. The short answer is everything. And basically, when I came down to L.A., I was going to be a music lawyer. That was my point in being here. My wife and I came down. We got a place. Here we go. Within a few weeks, I had met a motion picture director by the name of Junichi Suzuki from Japan, and he wanted to do his first motion picture here. And with him and producer Komori, you know, I worked with them, and we eventually produced a film called Death Ride, which was a horror film, and we sold it, went through Lionsgate and through that. Through that process, you know, I was a music and technology lawyer. I learned, you know, I spent 6 months, all the money I made on the film I spent on books, dove into film production, and I learned top to bottom film production. And then when it came time to sell the film, then I got into film distribution agreements, and I learned everything there was to do about that, and I started taking on sales agents, clients, and distributors, and doing then that kind of evolved. And then that naturally evolved into the financing arena, which started with international deals and now is, you know, getting more into PPMs and stuff like that domestically. I kind of went backwards, reverse, because I work a lot with Japanese companies. So that's my long, again, another long rambling answer that I do pretty much, I could work at any capacity as an attorney on a film, and I do for everyone. And sometimes I am the guy negotiating the deal for the A-list actor with the agent. And on other pictures, I might be the guy that gets the agreement and they go, here are the deal points, put them in the agreement and let's go. It really depends on what the producer needs.
So you are adept at all levels of the production, all contracts you're familiar with.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, in distribution, I've done everything from the one-page VOD deal to we just closed a 120-page negative pickup, you know, or production, yeah, I didn't set out to do that, but by necessity, over the last 8 years, it's been a stage, excuse me, of learning the different areas. So I have clients in all three areas, production, financing, and distribution of motion pictures.
Well, if you've worked on 13 motion pictures, that would make sense that you know all of these things. And the best part is that you were current in that knowledge because of the way things keep changing in our industry.
Yeah, I think that was the one thing that was, for me, overwhelming at first is the amount that there is to learn about motion pictures. It was really like going to law school again. And, you know, luckily people such as yourself write really great. There's a lot of great resources from some really great people. John Collins is another person and different people across the country. But for me, there's so much to learn. It's astonishing, actually. And you never stop. You can't.
No, you can't. Well, do you write your goals out and keep them in front of you as a focus? Can you give us some tips on how you use this drum corps concept?
Well, it's not, for me, putting the drum corps element aside. So when I first became a lawyer, my first clients were rock bands, and they didn't have any contracts to negotiate because they had just finished their first album and they had like two fans and a hand sandwich, whatever. So for me, by necessity, I found myself drafting business plans for the artists. And these went from three-page guidelines to the more I learned about marketing and how the entertainment industry actually works, evolved up to where I was being hired by people and still do to draft business plans. And that went from music, and now it's more film business planning and how to get financing and all that. And so if you ask me, well, do you write out your goals? I have a business plan that I revise all the time, and it is in a binder, and it's 20 pages in terms of, you know, what I want to, because for me, there's so many different areas. If I just kind of wake up every day and just decide what I'm going to do, I don't think I'm going to go very fast or far in any area.
So you take an overview of what you want to achieve, and then you may have three or four areas of focus with to-do lists underneath those?
Yeah, and it's all tied together with the marketing scheme and so forth. Yeah, absolutely.
Good. Well, I teach intentional filmmaking where we do set our goals, so I totally believe in that. You really have to have a focus on where you want to go. So we set them usually for 6 months and for a year. Now, what is your time period?
That's about the same. It's about the same time frame.
Right. Yeah. And then, of course, sometimes you have to reset your goals because of changes here or there. And so it might go up or it might go down, but you were constantly on that path. Right.
Oh, of course. And the thing that I think to keep in mind about filmmaking is I tell my clients this is, A, you know, it's not about the lack of adversity or problems. It's about how you deal with problems. and, you know, that will be successful in producing a film. And any given timeline, this was the one thing to learn, because if you don't learn this, you will have a nervous breakdown in independent film. Everything takes a lot longer than you think it's going to take, for many factors, many of which are out of the producer's control. So it's really about, as you just said, readjusting your goal and sticking on task, you know, where you're going, and not completely losing your mind when the deadline changes, because it will. Yeah.
It's not what happens to you, it's how you react to what happens to you. Is that what you're saying?
That's said even better than I said it. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, you're so right. You're so right. Because so many things are out of your control in this industry, and it does take time. It's frustrating, but the results always come out to be something wonderful.
Yes,
particularly with a good team. So give us some advice for filmmakers on what to be aware of in contracts. For example, where have you found that filmmakers can make mistakes and perhaps give too much away in their contracts?
Okay, well, I don't know that anyone listening wants to hear a legal dissertation, but I would say this. There are two key areas that filmmakers can really screw up when you're doing an independent film. The first is putting the piece of paper aside. Who's going to lead the negotiations? You know, who's going to reach out to that talent agent? Who's going to reach out to the manager? And do they have experience and know how the industry works? You know, because there's a lot of unwritten rules or protocol. And, you know, if you're going to storm out of the gate and make your offer your lead role to three major actors at once, you're going to be in for a very interesting next couple of weeks when all hell breaks loose. So it's really making sure, A, you have that person in charge or team in charge. And the second one is, now getting back to the paper, is how you, the contract administration, you know, because the mistakes you can make, sometimes actors, you know, it gets very complicated in terms of the credits in a contract or MFN, the most favored nations, where someone says, hey, if I get this per diem, if anybody else gets higher than me, my per diem goes up or my daily rate. And the way that the different contracts interplay can be very confusing and difficult and will wreak havoc when you go to deliver your film down the road. So I would say being really, really organized in the contract process and really understanding what the contracts need to have to clear when you do give the film over to Lionsgate, because they're going to have a team of lawyers look at all the agreements in the film at that point.
Okay, so knowing what contracts need to have, and that would be the attorney who would tell you that, right?
The attorney will tell you that, but I think at a bare minimum, a producer needs to understand the few building blocks of what must be in a motion picture contract. The biggest example would be the no injunction provision. You know, and that's this little clause that you will find in every contract in every movie that gets distributed that basically says, you know, if the production company breaches the contract, you can sue them for money damages, but you cannot get an injunction to pull the film off the shelf. Because if you think about that, if somebody could have a dispute and then get the film pulled off of Netflix and wherever it ends up, or the theaters, that could completely destroy the system. So this provision, if you don't have this provision in your agreements, your film's not getting distributed, and you could put a period at the end of the sentence with that. So that's why I say, yeah, let the lawyer deal with it, but there still needs to be an awareness, I think, on the production team of what's getting signed and how it's getting signed.
Oh, right. So I totally agree with you. Producers are a brilliant group of people, in my opinion. I know from this, my favorite book about that is Producer to Producer by Maureen Ryan. And she actually has a whole chapter that says, in effect, do not panic when they hand you the contract. Take a look, and you should have something that is titled this, and that means that they're going to do this in there. So watch for this and watch for that. It's a beginning understanding of the contracts. And I think this is really important, what you're saying. So someone coming to you should have a basic understanding of some of the sections in the contracts. And that can be found in books and online, I guess, right?
Yeah, I think a producer, you know, the thing about if you say director of photography, you know what that skill set involves. You know what a costume designer does. A producer is kind of the odd man out because a producer, it really is producer specific as to what their skill set may be, right? Some producers have the ability to bring in money. Some producers have the ability to bring in talent. Some producers can draft a contract. Some producers can, you know, or any variation thereof. So I think it's a really, but having said all that, every producer needs to have, I think, if they're going to be hands-on with the production, have that fundamental understanding of a few contracts, you know, because like I said, if you're missing a publicity rights provision or something like that, it could be a disaster, and you don't need to pay an attorney $450 an hour to know that that provision needs to be there, I think.
Well, tell us, what is that provision?
Well, that was the publicity rights or the no injunction clause that I was talking about.
They're the same thing. Okay.
Yeah.
No injunction. All right. Well, your first suggestion is who's leading the negotiations, having a good team. Well, how do you interview someone to know whether they're good at it or what their status is or how? Because we don't know enough to tell.
Well, you know, to a certain extent, you can't tell until you really get into the thick of things. But having somebody with experience, especially in dealing with, if they're going to be talking to talent agents, especially, I think it's really important to have somebody with experience and that has good rapport that could come across the, you know, because look, at the end of the day, in any entertainment transaction, the role of the attorney or the producer who's negotiating the deal, whoever's closing that, you have to be very cognizant of the fact that when the deal's done, everybody works together. It becomes a team. So when the dust settles, you know, if you're fighting over royalty provisions and humiliating the other side and going crazy, and then when it's done, you sign, is that really success? No, I think you set the stage for the next war. So that's why I think it's really important to focus on somebody who can help build that bridge and understands the dynamics of, you know, talking to an actor with 30 years experience or an agent who's been there a long time and knowing how to navigate those waters without causing more problems.
Right. Well said. You're totally right. Because when you get on the set, it has to be a cohesive group. That's really the successful films.
Agreed.
Okay, so I've seen production agreements that are one page and production agreements 50 pages. So at a minimum, what do distributors require in your contracts? Could you tell us that?
Yeah, I think, you know, we kind of touched on a lot of this before. You know, there are a couple, I call them red alert provisions, like the no injunction clause and everything like that. And it's really not about contract length. Contract length is you can write a contract that captures all the rights for somebody to be in your movie that you need for distribution with Paramount or whoever in one page. It's very simple. You can also do that in 50 pages. And it really differs if you're going to have an actor that wants to, their counsel wants to talk about font size and credits or whatever. It really depends on that. But, you know, as I said before, the publicity rights, the rights grant itself, you know, warranties and no injunction provision, those are a few key provisions that you really, no matter how long your contract is, if those provisions are not in there, the ship's not going to sail. So it's really, if you're going to try to, you know, be your own production counsel, at the very least, you need to have a lawyer review your agreements before you go down that path. Because you don't want to make, I've seen that mistake made where they have to go back and have everybody on a film re-sign an agreement. That's not a particularly pleasant experience, usually.
No, I would think that'd be a problem, a lot of problems. Well, let me just ask you, when you take on a client who's producing a film, how does your experience in production benefit the client?
Well, if I'm strictly working on a film as the entertainment attorney, here's the contract we need, here's the deal points, great. Okay, I'm doing that, I'm negotiating. And then let's say something like a production date slips. And, you know, how do we tell the lead actor this? Or how do we communicate this with a financier? Different producer issues that come up, I can easily jump in and talk to them and kind of advise them as a producer. Well, look, as a producer, your responsibility is to the money, the financier. You have to look out for this, so you have to decide, you know, or talk them through various issues. So I think producing for an entertainment attorney is a good fit. Because once you get a little bit more hands-on with scripts and everything like that, the legal aspects become a lot more tangible, I think. It get a lot better understanding of how everything works.
Oh, that's brilliant. So you can start with the script on, everything in between. So at what stage do filmmakers come to you?
You know, at all stages, it might be, hey, we're going to, I've actually had the scenario of, hey, I have somebody wants to buy my film, I have no agreements. So we have to get the whole cast and crew in the theater and talk to them and convince everybody what's going on. You know, that is the absolute latest in the game in terms of production. I get involved very early in the game of, hey, look, how do we put this together? How do we approach cast? What cast do we want to approach? That's more producer hands-on. It really all different facets of the game. You know, I just did I think I alluded to before, a negative pickup agreement, and I hadn't heard of the film before, and they just boom. So it really, I come in at all areas of the game depending on when the lawyer's needed.
Right. Okay. But as a rule, filmmakers come to you when they are starting to raise money and they want to get their private placement memorandum, et cetera, or their business plan?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. All of the above. All of the above.
Okay. Well, let me ask, do you give your clients any advice on film funding that you could share with us?
Yes, absolutely. So it's really about understanding the game. So in 2008, I was a lawyer, of course, and you know, I'm doing a lot of production deals and everything, and I represented a sales agent distributor who goes to Cannes every year. So it was actually, you know, my mom of all people who said, you know, maybe you should go there and see what's going on. And literally, you know, I planned this trip to the Cannes Film Festival. I had a client there, but I had no idea what I was doing. I had no idea why I was going, and I just inserted myself into this world. And it was really walking around, you know, until that point, I had always thought that the analysis of a film project is somebody reading a script for a few hours, is somebody talking with writers, is this whole analytical process or watching the whole movie and discussing it and evaluating it. And then I went to Cannes, and I saw genre films being sold on the basis of a poster or a conversation over an espresso at Cafe Roma, and without anybody having seen the movie. And, you know, not that all deals are done like that, of course, but it was the epiphany, or it was one of many in this business that I've seen. And I was going, wow, you know what? I think if you're going to try to raise money or you're going to talk about how we're going to sell this film internationally, you need to understand the game that you're going to try to play. Because if you don't go to AFM or one of these finance or something where film transactions are being done, it's like trying to compete at the World Cup after watching soccer on TV. It's not going to happen. So for me, that one trip as a tourist led to, you know, going every year and acquiring friends and clients and projects and whatever and kind of getting into that world. But I would say if you want to talk about film financing, before you even talk to anybody about dollar one, get yourself a pass to AFM and go walk around and start talking to distributors and understand what they're looking for. And maybe they don't want the 250, you know, page script about Netflix or whatever. You know, maybe they want a 88-page horror film that you could shoot in a weekend. And there's all different aspects of it, but I think it's really understanding the game before you try to play it is the key concept.
So AFM, especially for people in L.A. or people in the United States, that is a great starting point, right?
That's probably the best. starting point. I mean, it's a lot cheaper than flying out to France and craziness like that. AFN, because it, for most of it, it's home court, you know, and it's a really, I went, you know, to this day, I'm still going to the seminars they host and everything, because they have a lot of great people and that come in and that speak. And the minute you think that you know it all and you can stop learning, the industry is going so fast. It's a fool's errand to think you can just master the game and check out and just, you know, be the wise person. You have to keep learning in this from everyone. So that would be my advice.
Great, great advice. Thank you. Well, because filmmakers want to know where to find investors, do you have any advice for them? Many people say to me that they did very well leaving Los Angeles because it's so competitive in L.A. and there's money all over the country. They did better outside of L.A.
Well, I think where you get the money from differs on every film and every person or every producer. You know, I produced a film where the money came from Japan and Germany. None of it came from the U.S., for example, you know, or whatever. It's just, it's really about your connections and your contacts. But I think if you said, well, how do you find investors? I don't think it's a matter of geography. Unless there's a certain, you know, I'm making a film about North Dakota. Well, think about it. You know, certain things come from that. But I really think it's about approaching investors. And I think the mistake I see is, you know, you have to understand that people who are in that position to either sign a deal with you for a film or to give you money, they are typically in a position of having people come to them each and every day and tell them how wonderful the project is and that they're going to make a million. You know, it's this whole litany of, or if it's a music project, we're the next Beatles or blah, 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 talking to the A&R. It doesn't stop. So if you want to work with an investor, you know, there are exceptions, but my philosophy is become their friend and not in a fake, you know, way, but really bringing them into your family of your production. Now, there's a line you can't cross for investment reasons where you can't, here, rewrite the script for us or whatever, but there is something to be said for inviting somebody on set and introducing them to the team and making them not feel like a part, but making them a part of the family. Because I think, you know, like I said, if you look at investing in a motion picture, well, technically, really, the only way it statistically makes sense day in and day out is if you have the resources to invest in a slate of films, right? Because studio films, maybe they, I don't know the exact statistics, but typically it's quoted, you know, they send out 12 or 15 films and 11 lose money and one makes so much money it pays for everything else. So, I think it's really about understanding the economic model is a key, and understanding that why people invest in film is because they want to be part of the industry. And there are economic reasons to invest in film, but when you hand them the PPM, remember, they're going to see a million different disclaimers and warnings about the film industry. And if they really feel like they're a part of the family, you know, I had just one last quick example. I have a client who once spent $150,000 to develop a motion picture of his own money. And, you know, we had a conversation recently, and he told me this, and he said, hey, I had spent $150,000, and the film never happened, and I have nothing to show for it. And I looked at him, and I expected this jaded, you know, statement about the film industry, and he said, it was the best $150,000 I had ever spent. And he was not kidding. He said, I met actors, I got to travel, I met all this stuff, I learned how a script is put together, and I'm ready to try again. And that's how we're interacting now. So it's really about bringing them into the industry, because I think it really is a wonderful and fun industry if you treat it right, I think.
Oh, it certainly is. Oh, the people that you meet will be your friends forever. And we're all in this boat alone together, as Lily Tomlin tells us. It's the truth.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, this is so important. And I often find that sometimes when you are asking for money, you really just, you sell the sizzle. You sell the Hollywood concept and being on the set and being part of the industry, and sometimes that's what it sells people, and that's what closes them. I mean, they want to think there is a chance to get some money back, but I think that that is, like you've said, is a great way to get people to invest in your film, is the sizzle of the Hollywood production.
Yeah.
So I'm with you 100% on that. The other thing is sometimes they want to give you money because they want to get their niece into a scene and, or get her on camera. This is one of the few industries that you could actually sort of buy your way into it at various stages.
Yeah, you can to a certain extent, right? You can invest in a movie and get a cast placement or things like that. I think the one thing you cannot do, I think historically, and many, many people have tried, is to literally buy your way to the top of the movie business. I think, people have come in and disappeared like the Bermuda Triangle when they try to just throw money around, because there are a lot of people who would take that money and it disappears and they're done. So buyer beware, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, tell us about producing your own films. Can you walk us through some of the steps that you took in the beginning that led you to your success?
I think the two projects I have right now that I'm producing that I wrote, have really, really been a journey. And I wouldn't call them a success yet. I have produced a lot of films, but I think for me right now, the thing that is driving me as a producer is kind of the next frontier, the challenge. You know, I did the UCLA screenwriting program. I wrote this script, My Immortal. It's a vampire movie. I couldn't get anybody to read the script because, and I was trying to get a director. Then I wrote the novel. The novel kind of had lightning strike it. It got ranked in Entertainment Magazine pretty high, number three or five or whatever it was, and kind of things went from there. But I'm still in the midst of that journey. I think for me it's really about, I had to a couple times, you have to go, okay, what is the end goal? And don't, when the adversity hits, just keep going. And in the last 2 months I've had, in this and Goodbye Blue Sky, the sci-fi film I'm working on, there's been a really big, significant change, and it's getting very exciting right now, but it's a journey, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But just keep focused on the goals and keep moving forward.
Yeah.
Well, so let me ask you what you think are some of the most important aspects to the funding process. Would you say it's the paperwork or the pitch or your attachments?
Based on all of the movies that I have seen financed since day one, there's only one answer to that question, and it's your cast. Because I have seen some great movies with no cast get made, and then the deal that they have at the end of the day is heartbreaking, what they can get with it. And then I have seen movies that get cast attached, and it just, things go. So I think, especially in international, there are not a lot of actors who can drive international sales. And one big mistake I see producers make sometimes is they will bank on a TV star that they love, that is popular in the U.S., and then you look at the international sales, and the sales agent has not heard of that star, and it doesn't help. So I think cast gives your film value. Having a great director would be number two for me. I think it gives your film stability, and if you have a great director, it should be able to lead to great cast, which just solves everything. But if you have a name on your project, you can go, and you're going to get attention anywhere from anybody. That it's just the reality of the game.
Right. Absolutely. Okay, well, do you advise filmmakers to have a PPM drafted for their project or to get out and start pitching the film and see if there's some money out there and then come do the PPM and the business plan?
At the end of the day, if you're going to take money from people, no matter what exception under the securities laws or whatever game you're playing, you're going to need that documentation. Because if something goes wrong down the line, you're going to want to have everything have been in compliance with securities laws, and because you will get sued by everybody and their brother if you don't have this taken correctly. However, like a Kickstarter campaign, you know, they say successful Kickstarter campaigns, the theory is typically to line up a lot of your potential investors before you hit the green button and actually launch, you know, so you get the momentum and get that. I think the PPM is the same way because, you know, there's one exception, but generally you can't send your PPM out to 5,000 people and hope for the best. I mean, if that's your financing strategy, if you're going to spend $5,000 or $7,000 or whatever on a PPM, and then you're going to get it and you're going to go through all of it because it takes a ridiculous amount of time, and you're going to go to people, you know, you want to make sure that you have a game plan. Otherwise, you're probably tossing your money away. And I think the other thing about a PPM is the first question I get asked, which it's comical now that I kind of understand how the business a little bit. Oh, do you have a good example you could just give me, or do you have one you could print off online? Have you found one online that we could just print out and use for our film? And if you think about it, so you're going to go ask someone for $3 million or whatever your budget is based on something you found on Yahoo and just print it out. I mean, there are legal disclaimers and all that you need in a PPM, but there is also the element where you explain the industry. But more important than that, somebody reading that PPM needs to know everything about you and your plan and your business, and it needs to sell the movie. And not in a way that's going to completely contradict all of the securities laws and the reason for a PPM, but I think the place where a lot of people fail with the PPM is thinking it's some kind of magical form that you print out, and there it is. Yes, okay, investors, some of them may not read. There's legendary stories. Oh, great, I've seen this, da-da-da-da. But for every one of them, there's 10 people who are going to read about you and your film and your business experience, and they want to honestly be told, hey, this might not be make money, but we're trying to make a lot of money. This is the mission here. And explain why and how and the risks. And that's how I see deals closed, is putting the time and effort into that step and not just thinking some magical document you print out, because that almost never works.
So that's one of the beginning things, that you take the time and get it right, so that when you go to close it, when they're ready to put their money in, that you've got the papers to support your ask and that you're legally intact, right?
Because that documentation is going to be reviewed by an attorney who's probably very, very good at what they do. And the sales elements of that, so to speak, the PPM, might be reviewed by your investor and his family and whoever. And that's mission critical. And once you launch your offering, it's not a document you can change every day as you think of a better idea. This is it. So, yeah.
Good. All right. Let me ask you, what do you think of this new Jobs Act where filmmakers can market their films online? Are you recommending this to any clients?
You know, I think the determination of whether you're going to jump into whatever, you know, if you're going to go under 506C that allows the general solicitation now, you know, think the rules are changing a little bit. I think before you decide that you're going to go advertise your film and try that route and, you know, go into the new frontier, you need to talk to an attorney, you know, somebody preferably very good like John Combs or whoever, because when you do the solicitation, different rules apply. And you might be limited to, or you are limited to, talking to accredited investors, and then there's extra steps to verify that these are accredited investors and not just somebody giving you their life savings that it's going to blow up. So, you know, I'm distilling down a very complicated area and simplifying it, but in general, I would just say, if you're going to go into that and you're going to say, hey, we're going to market this, we're going to sell units to everybody all over the place and it's going to be great, check in with a lawyer, because the odds of making, or the result of making a mistake in the area of securities law are not funny. I mean, it gets very ugly all the way up to criminal, repercussions. So be very, very careful in that area.
Okay. All right. Basically, from what I've read about the Jobs Act, you're still going to have the business plan, the BPM. You still need the lawyer to get you set. You've still got all the expenses you would have in starting in the startup expenses. So the only good thing I see about it is that, yes, you can put it online, but you really have to have an attorney helping you, because now you have to vet your own people, and that's where the scary part comes in, because if you make a mistake there, then you're in trouble, like you just said. So I would think that that would be the major benefit, being able to advertise or promote it so that the rule of 38 asks is not there for you. But this is only for $1 million, right? You can only raise $1 million?
Yeah, I believe so. I think the key really, though, is understanding who the investors are. Because, again, if the plan is, well, we're just going to put it online and hope to raise $1 million, we're going to hope for the best, I don't think that works. Or I think that's a lottery ticket. Maybe it works. Maybe there's this cool story. Hey, I raised $1 million. It's all good. But I really think it's raising money for a motion picture, because the stakes are so high, and it's usually somebody else's money, right? So you have a fiduciary duty to how you're going to handle that money. It's not an area that you can treat like the Wild West. You don't need to spend $100,000 to prep your film to get finances or anything, but you have to be careful in this area. I can't emphasize that enough.
Okay, great. Thank you, because that is exactly how I feel about it. I don't have enough law, but I have enough common sense to know that could be scary. You really have to be prepared. But now I'd really like to know about your next creative endeavor. I understand that you're going to direct a science fiction film called Goodbye Blue Sky.
Oh, God. Yeah. So okay. My vampire movie, as you know, I started to tell you the story. It had been this long, arduous quest and a great deal of frustration. And 2 years ago in Cannes, somehow the city, kind of my little universe revolves around this wacky festival, but I had a moment of intense frustration. I was having lunch with a producer, colleague of mine. He produces for some major studios. And, I had my moment where it was just like, what the heck am I doing here? This is ridiculous. My film is not moving. I should just go home, go play, video games, whatever. I'm just disgusted with the film business. Everybody has that moment or some point. And my colleague looked at me and he said, you know what the problem is? He said, you wrote the script. You're selecting the costume designer. You have the vision here. You know how it's going to be shot. He's like, you should direct. By definition, that's what you are. And I laughed at him because it just seemed like the most preposterous thing I had ever been told. And I blew him off for 4 months, or for 5 months. And then back in L.A., it happened again, where somebody told me that. And when it happened kind of the third time, and I talked to a colleague, and when I said, well, I'm thinking about this now because people won't shut up, and people got my friends and pals got very, very excited about it. So then I was like, well, okay, my vampire film is too high of a budget for a first-time director. I don't want to spend another 10 years, 20, 30 years trying to make this happen when it's physically impossible. So I optioned a short story called The Song. And The Song is, long story short, it's about this DJ who finds a compact disc and he plays it on his over the radio station, and the song goes out into the population and it affects the town. Long story short, it's like the aliens are setting the stage with this music for the invasion, like Invasion of the Body Snatchers. So I loved the concept, but I figured, a compact disc does not make a great protagonist for a movie. It's ridiculous. But what if it was an alien, a beautiful alien operative who got shot down? And it took off from there, and it evolved to this character named Flower, who gets shot down near San Francisco, She wanders into the city. She gets discovered singing on the street, Ave Maria in Italian, because she hears things and she can repeat it perfectly. And she joins a band, and the band takes off. And, of course, the evil music industry is hype, and they're making all this money. But the fans in San Francisco are being affected, and then it takes a very dark turn and kind of, you know, Flower falls in love with Earth, and then they send another. It just became this crazy idea for a film. And, you know, I had a lot of people in the beginning go, well, this doesn't even make sense. This is kind of like chaos and science fiction and comedy and all this stuff. And we stuck with it, and we shot some of it. We brought an actress in from Japan, and we shot part of the movie in a little bit in December for Section 181, which is a whole other story. But it kind of took off. So now we're talking to pop stars now for playing the role of Flower, pop stars from Japan and Korea we're looking at right now. And it's really becoming director. I wasn't one of those people who sat around deciding to do it. It just kind of naturally evolved. But I've surrounded myself with a lot of talent, and because I realized if I just was going to storm around and pretend I'm this creative genius, get out of my way, this is going to fail. Filmmaking is about a team. So yes. I made sure I had the best DP that I knew in the world, and I just went down the list and built the best team I could. And this is actually picking up speed right now. So somehow, some way, through all this crazy journey, I'm a director. Yeah.
Oh, how exciting. Well done.
Thank you.
Congratulations. That sounds so wonderful. All right. Well, let me just ask. We're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask if you could give us any tips on how to organize your production team for the movie.
You know, I use a catchphrase from a Silicon Valley company I used to work at a long time ago, Vividents, and they were always looking for super smart, super nice people on their board of directors and running the company. And I always thought that was great, and I think that's, you know, I'm looking for people that can think out of the box and who are passionate and driven. But more importantly, I want to work with people that when the stress and chaos hits, that I know that we're going to come together and solve the problem and not point fingers at one another, because if you have that kind of team, it's not a long-term successful proposition. Because when the chaos hits, which it will, if your team is experienced and just going, okay, whatever, you screwed up, I screwed up, let's fix it, your film's going to get made, and it's going to be fun.
Exactly. How well said. Thank you so much. Well, all right, tell us how people can find you, please.
Okie doke. I am on, my website is drumlaw80.com, like drummer and then lawyer 80, drumlaw80.com. That's Twitter as well, drumlaw80. And I have a blog called Seven Thoughts. It's a WordPress blog, and that's me.
So is seven the number, or you write it out? Which is it?
Oh, for Seven Thoughts?
Yes.
The actual URL of this is, let me see here, it's all written out.
S-E-V-E-N, thoughts.com?
Yeah. Seventhoughts.wordpress.com.
.wordpress.com.
Yeah, that's the part I was missing. Or actually, or leerudnicki.wordpress.com is even easier.
R-U-D-N-I-C-K-I, right?
Yeah. I guess I have both of them here. Yeah, leerudnicki.wordpress.com.
Lee, can we find you anywhere else on the Internet, perhaps in social media or any other place?
Facebook. Everything that I have is pretty much drumlaw80. I've stuck to that. I've made it my little trademark, so to speak. So except for leerudnicki.wordpress, my blog, everything else is drumlaw80. So, yeah.
Great.
My law firm is also on Facebook as well.
I'm sorry, your blogs are on Facebook too?
Oh, my law firm. The Rudnicki Law Group is on
there.
Yeah.
Law firm. Okay, yeah. Good. Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to meet you and to learn about you and your success. And you you're in the right business. Tenacity, faith, belief, confidence, all those things are. But the fun part of me for this interview has been to see how much fun and enjoyment you are having, learning and striving at the same time in the film industry. So I wish you great success, Lee, and I thank you very much for sharing with us.
Thank you so much. I had a great time. I'm going to buy your book, by the way. And it was very fun. Thank you.
Okay, you are an angel. Thank you very much, Lee.
Okay, goodbye.
Bye.
Take good care, all.
I want to remind our listeners that David Raiklin is a brilliant and talented award-winning musician who scores films and can compose music for a trio or for a full orchestra. David is a very good friend to the independent filmmaker and comes highly recommended by From the Heart Productions. If you need music to help tell your story, please contact him at davidraiklin.com. That's David, RAIKLEN.com. And Carol and I want to thank you for tuning in to The Art of Film Funding. Please visit our website at FromTheHeartProductions.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Good luck with your films, everyone.